I will be forever the method.
You're the king of kings,
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please visit our website at bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right hand corner, you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon sponsor. All right. Welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to read some more magazine articles. I was not able to secure a guest for the show this week. I've been trying for the last couple of weeks, haven't found anybody. So we are going back to our old standby of delving into some of these old bodybuilding magazines, which I have a ton of, and I'm going to read some good articles here from the 1970s and the 1980s. I don't even know if I got any from the 80s. I got some old ones from the 70s, mostly Muscle Builder. And I got a good article from that Muscle Mag Annual, which I love, these Muscle Mag Annuals, where there's only about four of them. I also have an article that was kind of inspired from my last interview with Tony Pearson and the director, Andrew Menjivar, who put together a documentary on Tony's life based on Tony's book, Driven. And part of the book, and also a big part of the movie, because I was able to see the movie, actually, a big part of the movie was when Tony won the Mr. America title in 1978, and then the controversy that surrounded that contest. So I did a little research and looked at some of the contests from that year. Tony won the Junior Mr. USA and Junior Mr. America that summer, and then Ron Tupel won the Mr. USA. So it was really a big rivalry between Ron and Tony, and Ron was the favorite by far, but Tony upset him. So I got the score sheets out and I looked at that and I looked at all the previous contests that they entered that summer. And I wrote a little article about it for my newsletter, which is the Bodybuilding Legends podcast newsletter that goes out to all our Patreon sponsors. So I thought I would read this article for you guys, give you a little preview of the newsletter. So if you are a Patreon sponsor, you will receive this newsletter several times a month. We usually talk about various topics in the old school bodybuilding world. And like I said, this time I just started to write this little article and it turned out to be a big article. So I thought I would share it with you guys. All right. What else is going on? Danny Padilla had a birthday not too long ago, April 3rd, just this last week. Danny is now 72 years old and still doing well. I did an interview with Danny, I believe, was it last year or the year before? And it was one of my favorite interviews. Danny is a great interview and he's very funny, had a lot of great stories. And of course, one of the greatest bodybuilders in the history of the sport, the original Giant Killer, and was the 1977 IFBB Mr. America winner and also Mr. Universe winner. And then was a great force in the pro scene in the late '70s, early '80s. Of course, his peak was the 1981 infamous Mr. Olympia that Franco won, and Danny was relegated to fifth place, and he was in his most ripped condition at that contest. But Danny is still a legend, and I'm glad he is still around and still healthy and happy. So happy birthday to Danny Padilla. All right. What else is going on? My training is going good. I've been training hard since I got back from Chicago for my birthday, which was about a month ago. Lost an inch and a half my waist so far. So the diet is going good. I've been really, really staying on point with the diet, writing down every day. I've been doing cardio about 4 days a week and been training's been going great. I just had a really great leg workout. If you follow me on Instagram or on my Facebook page, you saw the video. I went up to 345 on squats, which was pretty heavy. 315 for me is pretty heavy at my age, the ripe old age of 60. So I pushed it a little bit, went up to 500 on the vertical leg press for sets of 10. I was doing stiff-legged deadlifts with 265, and then squats. I was going to go up to 355, but I went up to 345, went down just a little bit, and got three sets of five with that. But that thing felt heavy, but it felt great. God, it's such a great feeling of accomplishment when you get done with workouts like that. I was actually nervous about that leg workout all week long because I knew what I wanted to do. And a lot of people think I'm still crazy for training heavy, but hey, as long as I can do it, I love doing it. Why not? Sure, I won't be able to do it forever, but can still do it right now. What else is going on? I'm still doing the Muscle Maturity podcast. If you guys want to check that out, that's on YouTube every week. It's usually up every Wednesday because we film it on Tuesday. So that's me and Samir Banute and Nick Trigilli. Nick Trigilli, of course, has his own YouTube channel called Bodybuilding and BS. It used to be called Bodybuilding and Bullshit. Now it's called Bodybuilding and BS. Nick is sponsored by Old School Labs, as I am and Samir is. So we just talk about what's going on in bodybuilding every week. But what we've been doing lately is I had them do a segment on the history of bodybuilding. So now we're talking a little bit about an old school contest. This week, this last week, we talked about the 1972 Mr. Olympia. Nick is a little bit younger than me and Samir, so he doesn't know much about the history of that. So I was telling him all about when Sergio was favored or should have actually won that 1972 Mr. Olympia, one of the most controversial Mr. Olympias that there was, if you look back at the history of the sport. But Arnold won that contest. That was his third Mr. Olympia, and Sergio did not come back to the Mr. Olympia after that contest until 1984, when Wayne D'Amelio talked him into making a comeback, but that was well after Sergio's peak. So we always wonder what might have been, right? What might have been if Sergio and Arnold would have kept competing. I wish Sergio would have did the Olympia the next year. Of course, he did that Mr. International contest in Tijuana, Mexico, and he challenged Arnold to come up on stage, and Joe Weider was with Arnold, and Joe Weider told Arnold, don't go up on stage. And then a couple of weeks later was the Mr. Olympia, and Sergio did not show up. And then they suspended Sergio for life, I think, after that contest. And they also took away the Mr. International contest from Eddie Sylvester. He was not allowed to promote that show anymore. So that was really some controversial times in bodybuilding. But unfortunately, Sergio hated Joe Weider. He hated the IFBB, thought he was being ripped off. And we were denied those more showdowns between Sergio and Arnold, which would have had a few more of those. But they only met on stage, I think, four times. 69 Olympia, 70 Mr. World, 70 Olympia, and then the 72 Olympia was the last one. All right, I got some emails here from the last couple of weeks. This one says, hey, John, I love the show and I listen every week. I was just wondering, I see you still train heavy, especially with back training. I've heard you talk about having compressed disc on a few episodes. I currently have been suffering with a herniated L5 for the last 6 months, and I sometimes struggle with training. I was wondering, how did your injury occur, and how do you get on with your disc issue in general? Does it have good and bad days? Regards, Ollie from the UK. Well, it's not really an injury, Ollie. It's just I have compressed disc from all the years of training, so I just have to be really careful with it. You know, sometimes it's inflamed and it just kind of hurts, but it's not anything where I can't move or it's never anything like that. And I always try to control my training, and I'm smart with what I do. Even though I do train heavy, I never do something if I don't feel like it's like I'm going to get hurt. I'm always very, very careful. As far as getting around it, what I'll do usually every day is I'll go on the inversion table. I have one in my house, and they also have one at the gym I go to, Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club in Tampa, Florida. And they also have the Powerhouse Gym in Brandon, Florida. And they have inversion tables at both of those places. So I'll usually go on there anywhere from 5 minutes. Lately, I've been getting up to like 8 minutes. And I'll usually do that first thing in the morning. Right after I take a shower, I'll hang on the inversion table. And then that decompresses my spine, and it actually gives you a little space in between the discs. So that really helps. And then usually right after that, I'll do yoga. And I have a 20-minute, very basic, it's beginner's yoga. I've been doing beginner's yoga for like 25 years. I haven't progressed. But I just do that. It's just basic stretching for like the hips, the lower back, the hamstrings. Only takes like 20 minutes, so it's not too bad. I was really lazy with that. I wasn't doing it for the longest time, but now in the last month, I've been doing it almost every day, and it really feels, my back really feels a lot better. My hips aren't as tight, so I really recommend that to anybody who's having issues with their lower back to do some yoga. I also sometimes stretch at the gym, but I think the yoga exercises are even better. It just seems like it's more effective than the stretching. And yeah, that's about it. I mean, like when I do leg days, I'll always start with abs because I do hanging knee raises for my lower abs. And that seems to really stretch my lower back and it kind of warms it up. And then I'll always do hamstrings. Well, I'll do abs first and then I'll do hamstrings second. So I'll do like some kind of leg curl and then some kind of stiff-legged deadlift. And the stiff-legged deadlift seemed to kind of strengthen and tighten up my back. And then I'll go to quadriceps and I'll usually do leg extensions first to warm up. And then I'll do some kind of leg press exercise, which is very heavy. And that really kind of pre-exhausts my legs. And then I'll do squats last. And my training partner, who's only like 26, always complains because he wants to do squats first. He wants to see how strong he is. But I keep telling him with my knees and my back, I have to go and do squats last. So like I said, I've been pushing the squats. I'm up to usually 315 or sometimes a little heavier like I did this week. And then back training, I'm still able to do T-bar rows with like five plates or sometimes barbell rows instead of T-bars, which I'll go up to maybe 250 or 260. And then I like doing two-arm dumbbell rows. I'll do one-arm dumbbell rows too. But the two-arm dumbbell rows are really good. I just try to keep my lower back really arched, keep very tight, and I'm up to the 120 dumbbells on those. So I go really heavy on those as well. So yeah, it goes good. You just have to take it day by day. And I remember like 20 years ago when I was training really heavy, I was always throwing my back out, like really hurting it. So that's when I kind of changed my training and I stopped doing deadlifts. I'll do stiff-legged deadlifts, but no regular deadlifts because that just puts way too much pressure and it really compresses my spine. So I'm able to do stiff-legged deadlifts because the stress is going more on the hamstrings. And as long as my lower back is arched, it actually, like I said, kind of strengthens my lower back. And I'm still able to get away with doing squats and some of those back exercises. So, yeah, just taking it day by day, but it's not really an injury. I don't have any herniation or anything like that. It's just dealing with that compression, but the inversion table helps and the yoga definitely helps. All right. This letter says, hey, John, congratulations on your recent landmark birthday. And thanks so much for your different versions of your legend show. I primarily watch it on YouTube, plus your other regular segments on RX Muscle and the Old School podcast, the Muscle Maturity podcast. But I also try to catch the podcast on Apple whenever possible. They are all great. I'm interested in the old muscle mags you have possibly. So if you can send me a list of what is available and the prices, that would be appreciated. In the day, in my teens and early 20s, I got them all. And I mean them all. I would be interested in seeing some examples again. I'm primarily interested in the ones you might have from the mid 70s to the very early 80s. Thanks. Now I know it's busy to ask this, but difficult for you to make the connections if they are possible. But personally, I would love to hear more about a couple of topics or persons. The first is Cal Scalak. I have seen or heard most of your total suite of podcasts, and I don't think you've ever had Cal. True. The story of Cal taking his portfolio from Joe Weider is great, and I would like to hear about that directly. But even more, Cal was a real force when he burst on the scene. I'm a little older than you, and I don't know if it made the impact, but he was a real force. The talk was always the next Arnold. I remember when he beat Mensur, and it was a huge deal. I think he is around. If you Google him, you see about his later biking career. Anyways, I wondered about how or why he suddenly disappeared. The second idea might be easier and may interest you, but I would love to hear someone talk more about Dan Laurie. Muscle Training Illustrated and the WBBG were very popular, and he has a storied past in terms of his dealings with Weider and the shows in New York, etc. I wonder if someone like Boyer Coe would speak about Dan or if there are other bodybuilders still around who competed in the WBBG. I always wondered about Laurie, and I do think he had an impact, but he has pretty much faded away while Weider is still a legend. Anyways, just a few suggestions. Thanks again for all you do, and I look forward to hearing about possible magazine purchases. John. All right. Thank you, John. Those are some great suggestions. I sent John my list of magazines. If anyone out there is interested in purchasing some old bodybuilding magazines, I have a lot of doubles, so I'm getting rid of a lot of the ones I have. So just send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I would love to talk to Cal, man. That would be my dream interview. But from what I heard from Sean Ray and many other people, Cal does not want to talk about bodybuilding. And I don't know how to reach him. I don't see him on social media at all. I don't know anybody who knows him. I remember a couple of years ago, I talked to a girl. I think I met her on Facebook or something. I didn't know her, but she mentioned something about knowing Cal. So I talked to her. And she said, I think she said he's like, he's kind of born again. He's into religion and he absolutely does not want to talk about bodybuilding. So some of these guys like Cal and Bob Paris for sure, they just don't want to talk about it. And I know Cal had a real, I think, bad feelings about Joe Weider and about the politics of bodybuilding, but I would love to talk to him about that. I'd love to talk to him about his whole career because I agree with you. He's one of my favorite bodybuilders when I grew up because when I started bodybuilding in 1977, Cal won the Mr. Universe that year and he beat Mike Mentzer and that was a big upset. And I love Cal's physique. He had an Arnold look to his physique with the big arms, the huge chest, the great side chest, the great double biceps. I loved his physique. I used to look at Cal as inspiration for my training because I wanted to look like that. I wanted to look like Arnold and I wanted to look like Cal. So I know his legs were a little weak and I was actually at the 1978 Mr. Olympia. I got to see Cal compete. So I was lucky enough to see that. He really brought the house down every time he came out because he was so ripped. And when he hit all those most muscular poses, he just brought the house down. So, yeah, I would love to talk to Cal, but I don't know how to get a hold of him, but I'll definitely look into it for sure. And the, Dan Laurie idea is a great idea. I know Anibal Lopez competed in a lot of Dan's shows, so he might be someone good to talk to. And like you said, Boyer Co. But yeah, Dan was a big force in bodybuilding and he did a lot. He had his magazine. He had his organization. Tony Pearson also competed in the WBBG. And you're right. He is kind of forgotten about. And Joe Weider is still highly regarded as a legend. So, and I know it's ironic because Dan and Joe started off as friends and then they had a huge falling out and they hated each other. And of course, bodybuilding was really interesting back then because Joe Weider had his rivals and Dan Laurie was one of them and Bob Kennelly was another one. And, of course you had Iron Man, which was written by Perry Rader. He wasn't really a rival of Joe Weider, but it was another magazine. And then you had, of course the Hoffman magazines, which hated Joe Weider. So they hated them and Joe hated them. So it was a really interesting time in bodybuilding because there were so many different magazines and different organizations. But that was a pretty fun time. But yeah, I would definitely look into that. It's a great idea. All right. If any of you guys have any other letters you want to send me or emails you want to send me, just send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com and I'll read your letters or your emails on the air. And also if you're interested in the magazines, just send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com and I'll send you the list that I have. And if you're interested in signing up for my newsletter, Bodybuilding Legends newsletter, that goes out to all our Patreon donors. So I have the link to become a Patreon donor. I have the link below in the description of this podcast. So just check that out. For as little as $5 a month, you will receive the newsletter every month, usually a couple times a month. And I also give an audio article, like the articles I'm going to read today. I'll read another article that only goes out to the Patreon donors. And if you're a Mr. Olympia Patreon donor, which is the highest level at $20 a month, then you also receive a video article where I read an article and I put the pictures from the magazine in there with it. So it's a little something extra that I'm giving back to our Patreon supporters who help support the show. All right, guys, let's get to some of these articles. The first one I want to read is from the newsletter that I just came out this week. This is the Bodybuilding Legends newsletter. This was my third one. And as I said, I started writing an article about Tony Pearson winning the Mr. America and it ended up being a long article. So I want to read this to you guys and I'll share this with you. All right. I say, I hope you guys enjoyed the interview with Tony Pearson and director Andrew Menjivar last week on the podcast in which they discussed the documentary film Driven, the Tony Pearson story. I had a chance to watch a sneak preview of the movie and it was very good. It told the story of Tony's amazing life in which he overcame poverty and child abuse by escaping to the Mecca of bodybuilding via a one-way bus trip to California at the tender age of 19 years old. Tony won the Mr. Venice Beach contest in his first year in California. After winning this contest, Tony boldly declared that he would win the Mr. America title in 2 years. Everyone thought he was crazy, but sure enough, 2 years later, in 1978, Tony was announced as the new Mr. America winner over class winners Ron Tufel and Manuel Perry. As the saying goes, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. After Tony achieved his dream of winning the coveted Mr. America title in 1978, the resultant criticism of the decision and the bad publicity that followed all came down on Tony himself. He was blamed for the unpopular decision, and the next few years found him on the outside looking in as he was not allowed to compete in the IFBB as a professional and was even denied the chance to guest pose and make money from the sport that he so deeply loved. Incredibly, Tony ended up homeless again, the same as he was when he first relocated to California, but this time he was the current Mr. America. The 1978 Mr. America was one of the most controversial events in that competition's long history. I thought it would be beneficial to look at the judges' score sheets from that contest and see what actually happened. The short class featured 14 competitors, and it was a three-man race for first between Ron Tufo, Tom Platz, and Carlos Rodriguez. Ron was the heavy favorite going into the show, as he won the short class at last year's Mr. America contest. In early 1978, Ron moved from his hometown of Pennsylvania to California to train at Gold's Gym and get some publicity in the magazines as he prepared to win the Mr. America that year. Ron recognized that the two previous Mr. America winners, Cal Scalak and Dave Johns, had two things in common. They both trained at the world-famous Gold's Gym, and they each won the Mr. California in the same year that they won the Mr. America. By training at Gold's Gym all year and winning the Mr. California that year, Ron was checking all the boxes to ensure that he had the best chance of winning the Mr. America in 1978. In April of 1978, Ron entered and won the Mr. California contest. The victory was an easy one for Ron, who looked dramatically improved from a year ago. His thick, muscular physique was ripped to the bone, and he won the short class and overall title over some very stiff competition. One of the top competitors who Ron beat was a young Tony Pearson. Tony did not have any big title win under his belt at the time of this contest. He won his class at the junior division of the Mr. Los Angeles and the Mr. Southern California the previous year, but at this event, he was just a hungry young bodybuilder looking to make a name for himself. The tall class winner at the 1978 Mr. California was the very impressive Larry Jackson. Larry had not competed in 2 years, but his muscular physique definitely got the attention of the judges at this contest. In addition to winning first place in the tall class, Larry also won most of the body part awards, including most muscular, best chest, best back, and best poser. Tufo won best legs and best abdominals. It was looking like this might be a preview of the showdown at the Mr. America between Larry Jackson and Ron Tufo. On August 19th, 1978, Ron Tufo won the AAU Mr. USA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The contest was held only 2 weeks before the Mr. America, so this was a good warm-up for Ron, and it allowed a preview of the physique that he would show in Cincinnati. Iron Man magazine described Ron's physique as massively muscular with startling definition throughout, and his muscle tone and density left little to be desired. On September 2nd, 1978, Ron appeared on stage at the Mr. America in his characteristic ripped and muscular shape. At 5'5" and 184 pounds, Ron looked slightly flatter than the condition he displayed at the USA 2 weeks earlier, but he was still the heavy favorite to win his class. Tom Platz, who was second to Ron in the short class 1 year earlier at the 1977 Mr. America, was dramatically improved. Standing 1 inch taller than Ron, Tom weighed in at 196.75 pounds, and the changes to his physique in only 1 year were startling. His impressive legs were even bigger, with slabs of thick muscle standing in for his quadriceps. His calves from the back were massive and striated, with fibers bursting out of the skin. Even Tom's upper body was unrecognizable, with pounds of new muscle all over his back, chest, and shoulders. The judges were gridlocked over the decision between Ron and Tom. Ron received 4 first-place votes to Tom's 3 first-place votes. Ron also got 2 seconds and 1/3, while Tom received 2 seconds and 2/3. Third-place finisher Carlos Rodriguez was in the battle as well, although he did not get any first-place votes from the judges. He was awarded 3 second-place votes and 4 third-place votes. The final tally was Ron Tufo first with a 7 score, Tom Platz second with a 9 score, and Carlos Rodriguez in third with a 12 score. Tony Pearson was having the best year of his bodybuilding life in 1978. After his disappointing second place finish at the Mr. California contest in April, Tony won the overall at the AAU Mr. Junior USA on May 14, 1978 in San Jose, California. In winning the first national level contest of the year, Tony defeated 21 bodybuilders, including 1977 Junior Mr. America overall winner Mario Nieves. Mario was 10 pounds heavier than a year ago and was clearly the most muscular man in the contest. He, in fact, did win the most muscular award along with best chest and best legs. Tony did not win any of the body part subdivision awards, but he did win the overall title of Junior Mr. USA. 1 month later, Tony continued his winning ways by taking the overall title of Junior Mr. America on June 17th in Austin, Texas. Tony defeated 22 of the best bodybuilders in the country to win his second overall national title. He defeated top bodybuilders like Dave Mastorakis, Gary Leonard, John Brown, and Bob Reese to win the competition. Tony was incredibly ripped at this contest, and during the heated pose down between him and class winners Mastorakis and Leonard, Tony momentarily blacked out from the intense exertion he expended to show the judges that he was his best. After Ron Tufel won the third national title, the AAU Mr. USA, in August, the stage was set for the big Mr. America title on September 2nd. Despite Tony's two overall wins at the national level, Ron was still the heavy favorite to take the title, according to the magazines and the industry experts. The medium height class at the 1978 Mr. America was stacked with talent from some of the best bodybuilders competing on the national stage. Tony Pearson, at 5'8 and almost 182 pounds, was one of the lightest competitors in the class. He was outweighed by 20 pounds by the formidable Larry Jackson, the tall class winner of the 1978 Mr. California contest. However, Tony was so sliced and ripped up that he achieved the unanimous decision from the judges. All seven judges gave Tony a one for a perfect score of 5 points. Larry Jackson garnered 4 second-place votes and 3 third-place votes to place second with a 12 score. And Richard Baldwin in third place displayed a more Apollo-type physique, and he was the lightest competitor in the class at only 172 pounds at 5'8". His scores ranged from second to eighth place, and he landed in third with a 15 score. The tall class was the least competitive of the contest with only 7 competitors. Manuel Perry, last year's surprise winner in this class, took first place again with a big and shapely physique that lacked the definition and polish that he had displayed in 1977. Regardless, Manuel was a unanimous winner in the class with straight first place votes from the judges. Top national competitor Clinton Barile took home most of the second place votes from the judges to score 10 points over Gary Leonard in third with 17 points. Leonard, the tall class winner at the Junior Mr. America contest in June, showed great promise, but he received only 1 second-place vote along with 3/3 and 3/4. The stage was now set for the exciting pose down between the three class winners to decide the coveted title of 1978 AAU Mr. America. Short class winner Ron Tufel, medium class winner Tony Pearson, and tall class winner Manuel Perry. Manuel, in spite of his great structure and gifted symmetry, was not defined enough to be in the running. This left Ron and Tony to battle it out for the overall title. And battle they did. Tony, displaying his brave underdog spirit, went after Ron like a desperate animal. Hitting most muscular poses to showcase his extremely ripped physique, the thicker Tufel started posing his calves next to Tony's much weaker lower legs. Tony, in response, bared his teeth as he pointed to his sliced quadriceps, an area that Ron always struggled to get ripped. The crowd was going crazy as the spirited pose down went on for minutes. Tony would not give an inch to the crowd favorite Tufel. As they traded pose after pose, each man not willing to give the other an edge, the knowledgeable bodybuilding audience started to cheer on the underdog Pearson. You couldn't help but admire this 21-year-old kid's tenacity and will to win. Finally, the pose down was completed and the MC grabbed the audience's attention as everyone waited to hear the final announcement. The new 1978 AAU Mr. America is Tony Pearson. The crowd went crazy at the declaration of the surprise winner. Pearson, initially oblivious to the fact that he was the winner, finally realized the truth when he saw Tufel acting upset right next to him. Perry stared blankly at Tony, who was finally registered shock all over his face as he realized that he had done it. He was the new Mr. America. Tufel was so incredulous at the impossible announcement that he was talking to himself and pacing the stage while the trophy girls clapped and smiled for the winner. How could this happen? For a full year, Ron believed in his heart and soul that he would be the next Mr. America. He relocated to the other side of the country, trained and dieted with unrelenting dedication, easily won the Mr. California and the Mr. USA, and now, disaster. It was the worst scenario in the world coming true. With no answers and unable to face this impossible reality, Tufel did the only thing that made sense. He walked off the stage in utter disgust. In examining the judges' score sheets, Tony was the pick of the majority of the judges for the Mr. America overall decision. Four judges, Mike Graham from Austin, Texas, Rodney Miller from San Francisco, California, Henry Wolfe from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Kent Keene from Santa Monica, California, gave Tony a first-place vote. Only two judges, Jim Mannion from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and John Carl Meese from Miami, Florida, thought Ron Tufel should win, and Byron Hudson from Oakland, California, was the only judge to put Manuel Perry in first place. Mannion and Meese each gave Pearson a second-place vote, while Hudson had Tony in third. Tufel was placed second by Miller, Wolf, and Hudson, while Kent Keene put Ron in third. Mike Graham and Keene had Perry in second, while Mannion, Miller, Wolf, and Meese had Manuel in third. Rumors and innuendos quickly followed the contest result. Many speculated that it was the Gold's Gym judges that gave Pearson the victory. Tufel apparently left California only months before the Mr. America contest after training in the Mecca for most of the year. He was no longer a Gold's Gym representative. Was the fix in for one of the gym regulars who represented the Mecca of bodybuilding? However, the only judge that could be referred to as a Gold's Gym judge was Kent Keene. Keene was a regular at Gold's, and he often served as a manager of the establishment. He did, in fact, award Pearson first place, and he relegated Tufel to third, but he was only one judge. Pearson also got first place votes from judges who were from Texas, San Francisco, and Pittsburgh as well. The main controversy of the contest was the decision to award the coveted Mr. America, the top amateur contest in the country, to a more ripped competitor over one who displayed better proportions and muscle mass. This was the late 1970s, and the concept of rip versus size was popping up at competitions all over the country. The current Mr. Olympia champion, after all, was Frank Zane, a bodybuilder who won based on his outstanding aesthetic qualities and extreme definition, and not his muscle mass. Mass monsters like Scott, Pearl, Schwarzenegger, and Oliva were products of the 60s and early 70s. As the decade of the 70s came to a close, being the most ripped competitor on stage could give the competitor the winning edge needed to defeat the monsters, despite a lack of muscle mass and even balanced proportions. It was a changing of the judging criteria that brought forth heated arguments about what characterized a winning bodybuilding physique. Before the night was over, another controversial decision took place. For the first time, the Amateur Athletic Union, the AAU, was working together with the International Federation of Bodybuilding, the IFBB. The American team that would be sent to the IFBB Mr. Universe contest was to be chosen at this contest from the competitors who entered the Mr. America contest. Any bodybuilder who wanted a chance to be a part of the American team that would represent the USA at the IFBB Mr. Universe could participate in the pose down in which a team would be chosen. Because the IFBB Mr. Universe was held in weight classes instead of height classes, there would need to be a separate competition to decide the American team that would be part of the Mr. Universe contest. The three weight classes would be the lightweight class, the middleweight class, and the heavyweight class. Carlos Rodriguez, the excellent bodybuilder who had taken third place in the short class of the Mr. America, was the unanimous pick of the judges to represent the lightweight class at the Mr. Universe. Mike Mentzer, a former IFBB Mr. America and a runner-up at the Mr. Universe for the last 2 years, was the only bodybuilder who showed up to earn a spot in the heavyweight class as the American representative. The big controversy took place in the middleweight class. A different set of judges was selected to pick the American team that would represent the country at the IFBB Mr. Universe. Those judges included Ralph Countryman from Oakland, California, Perry Rader from Alliance, Nebraska, the publisher of Ironman magazine, Ken Sprague from Santa Monica, California, also the owner of Gold's Gym, Don Nolan from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, Ken Peterson from Woodbury, New Jersey, Clarence Bass from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Franklin Page from Louisville, Kentucky. These were completely different judges who had just presided over the Mr. America competition. Ron Tufel, the short class winner, would have competed in the middleweight class because he was too heavy to compete as a lightweight. However, Ron had left the building after losing the controversial overall decision to Tony Pearson, so he was not available for the USA pose-down selection. Tom Platz, however, was contending to be the representative for the middleweight class. As a result, Tom would be posing down directly with the new overall Mr. America winner, Tony Pearson. At only 5'6" and a half, Tom outweighed Tony by 15 pounds, despite being an inch and a half shorter. Would these new set of judges choose the massive size and superior leg development of Platts over the more ripped but smaller physique of Pearson in light of what just occurred moments earlier at the Mr. America Posedown? In an extremely close decision, Tom Platts was chosen as the bodybuilder to represent the American team in the middleweight class at the IFBB Mr. Universe over Tony Pearson by a final score of 7-8, where the lowest score wins. Platts received the first place vote by four of the judges, Countryman, Nolan, Bass, and Page, while Pearson only received two first place votes from Rader and Sprague. A disappointed Tony Pearson ended the night as Mr. America, but he was not chosen to represent his country at the Mr. Universe. Because only Mr. Universe winners were allowed to turn pro and compete in the IFBB professional competitions, Tony had lost the opportunity to earn a living from bodybuilding. He had won the battle, but ultimately lost the war. As fate would have it, Tom Platts did go on to win the middleweight class at the 1978 Mr. Universe. The second place finisher in the short class of the Mr. America was now the best bodybuilder in the world in his weight class, and he was the newest IFBB pro for 1978. Carlos Rodriguez and Mike Mensur would also go on to win their respective classes, making history as the USA won every weight class at the IFBB Mr. Universe for the first time ever. Tony was a man without a country, and he was relegated to the sidelines. Without a victory at the Mr. Universe, Tony was not allowed to guest pose or compete in any IFBB competitions. The controversial decision at the 1978 Mr. America had made him the most hated bodybuilder in the country. After putting it all on the line to win the Mr. America and make his dream come true, Tony found himself without any opportunities to make a living. After months of struggling, he found himself unable to pay rent, and he was again homeless, just as he was when he first arrived in California 2 years earlier. Eventually, things got better for Tony. Basically shut out of the IFBB, he decided to go to Europe to compete in the rival organizations, the WABA and NABA. He first won the 1979 WBBG Pro Mr. World, which earned him a trip to the prestigious NABA Mr. Universe in London, where he took a very close second place to veteran bodybuilder Ahmet Anulu from Turkey after a heated posedown to decide the winner. The next year, Tony would win the professional NABA Mr. Universe, and he became popular throughout Europe with his many posing exhibitions and seminars. He proved again that you can't keep a good man down. Persistence and an unshakable belief in himself eventually allowed him to be a champion and a winner again on stage, despite what the judges or officials might say. All right, the end. Written by me. So I hope you guys like that. And as again, that is part of our newsletter that goes out every month on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast Patreon page. All right. Now, my next article comes from Robert Nalon. Robert is a photographer and also a writer in Australia, and he was around in the 1970s. And when Arnold was competing, Arnold traveled to Australia several times to guest pose. He loved it out there. So Robert used to write these great articles for Muscle Mag, and this one was in the Muscle Mag annual 7980, which I believe was their, I think this was their third out of four Muscle Mag annuals. They only had four of them. So Robert wrote this great article about Arnold coming to visit Australia, and Arnold, I believe, stayed with Robert. They were actually pretty good friends. So you get some real good insight into Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it says, Arnold Came to Dinner by Robert Nalon. In 1972, Arnold and Franco came out to Australia to guest star at the Mr. South Universe and Mr. Australasia. This was the first time they had been to Australia. The promoter had organized the show 6 months in advance, and he had posters in just about every gym in the country. The morning Arnold and Franco arrived, there was a big press meeting at the overseas terminal. I was out at the airport at 7:30 a.m. to wait for the arrival. The plane was late, and we were all anxious to meet them. Unexpectedly, Arnold walked out first. We were waiting at another gate, and to our surprise, he was behind us, chatting to a few people. The first stop was to the press room for the interview. Arnold had arrived from the American winter, so naturally he lacked a tan, etc. It was February, our summer, and everyone had a tan except them. The interview was interesting. The press, as usual, asked the same questions as they do the world over, but both stars answered all the questions with ease and added a little humor to them. Both the boys stripped down to their singlets and they gave a few of their best poses to the cameraman. I was standing across the other side of the room and Arnold waved to me and said hi. I'd never met him before and I didn't even have a chance to say hello when they were hustled off to the press room. I eventually found out that Arnold had seen a few of my photos in some of the English mags. He was familiar with most of the boys in the game. After the press room, about eight of us went out to eat at a restaurant upstairs. The 17-hour flight from Honolulu left the boys a bit hungry, so a steak and a light salad filled the stomach. They had another 600-mile flight to North Queensland, known as the Surfer's Paradise, one of the Australia's holiday resorts. The show was to be held in a week's time, so this gave them a chance to get a tan and get cut up a bit. The following Friday, I flew up north with a friend of mine, Paul Graham, a former Mr. South Pacific and a good friend of Arnold's. We kept ourselves entertained by quietly looking around the local spots and watching the girls parade around in their bikinis. That evening, a group of us consisting of around 10 or so went to a nightclub for a meal and entertainment. Arnold and Franco were amused by the Australian customs and habits. I noticed that Arnold was drinking a lot of beer, and since our beer has a higher alcohol content than America or Europe, it hit him all of a sudden. Not too much, but enough to affect him. The next day, the gym was packed with spectators and competitors from all over the country. Arnold and Franco were both on the judging panel. I noticed that Arnold was the first to finish the judging, which took about 2 or 3 hours overall. Afterwards, I sat down and I talked to a few of the boys. I presented Arnold with a sketch, a three-quarter back that I'd done of him a few weeks before. He was quite pleased with it, which made me very happy. The night of the show arrived. It was held at the Chevron Hotel and the theater was packed. It was a modern hall and had atmosphere. The start of the show went smoothly. It was well organized by Bob Bruce. He ran the gym in the area. The audience were awaiting the guest stars from overseas. Franco was the first to appear on stage and he gave an exhibition on deadlifting. He started at 600 pounds, which he did several times, one after another. Then he went up to 680 or 700. He impressed a lot of people that bodybuilders were strong. Both Arnold and Franco came out on stage and they did an individual routine and then they finished doing their famous duo. At this time, everyone was watching, including all the contestants. I remember before Arnold went on, he was pumping up backstage. Actually, it was the tent that had been erected besides the entrance door at the side. Anyway, I applied the oil to his back. It was the biggest back I'd ever seen. Awe-inspiring. It was like rubbing shoulders, so to speak, with the best feeling you can't describe. After the show, we all went out for a late dinner to another nightclub. All the guys could relax and go off their diet and have a good time. The night was long and we didn't get much sleep as we had to rise early and leave for Sydney. We called into Arnold's hotel to say goodbye as he was flying back to LA the next day and Franco was coming to Sydney as a guest star at the Mr. South Pacific. The show had been a success. Arnold made a lot of new friends and it was a new experience for him. Over the years, I kept up my correspondence with Arnold, and I noticed his improvement in the magazines. It was March 1974 that he was again to do a show in Australia. It was being held at the famous Sydney Opera House and one in Melbourne. The morning was cold, especially around 7 a.m. at the airport. The overseas flights always seemed to be early morning. This time, there was only a small gathering. Again, the press was there and TV coverage. Arnold always gives a good interview. From the airport, we drove straight to North Sydney over the Harbour Bridge, just under the bridge to the left where more journalists and photographers were waiting. This time, they took some photos using the Opera House, the venue for the show, and the Sydney skyline as a background. It was quite a cold morning over the north side. Arnold stripped down to his trunks for the photos, but he left on his shoes and socks because the grass was cold and wet. I brought my camera along, Miyama RB67, to get a few shots for myself. I only got a few, but good ones. Everything was a rush. After that, Paul Graham, Arnold, and myself headed for Channel 9 TV station. Arnold was to do an interview on an early morning woman's program. On the way, we called into the snack bar for a quick meal. We were starving, and it gave us a chance to relax. When we arrived at the TV station, we sat for about 15 minutes before anyone saw us. I suppose they were busy arranging a camera and a crew for the take. They also wanted a quick interview for the news since we were the only channel to miss the airport interview. The news interview was quick and they got straight into the women's segment. The girl asking the questions was about 6 feet herself and with high heels, she was taller than Arnold. He ended the talk by picking her up, licking his lips and walking off with her. After a hectic morning, we all headed back towards home. Paul had just booked Arnold into a nice hotel just 10 minutes away from my home which was handy for me as I would be showing them around the town. At that stage, I had my 71 Corvette convertible. It had just been painted bright yellow, a real eye catcher. Not many in Sydney either. Paul had arranged to pick Arnold up every morning at 8 o'clock. Arnold would have an early breakfast and then they would both train at Paul's gym for around 2 hours and sit in the sun afterwards to get a tan for the show. He arrived on the Tuesday and the show was on Saturday, so he had 5 days to get that finished look. He's lucky to have a good quality skin that tans quickly. The next few days were hectic, rushing around doing interviews for radio, talk shows on TV, etc. I took Arnold around to show him the sights in the afternoons. We had a quiet meal once or twice in the city, which was relaxing for him. I remember one time I parked a car in the city and I had a few errands to do around town. Arnold decided to sit and wait in the car. He said, "Don't be long." Although I was an hour and a half and on the way back, I saw him pacing up and down, cursing me. He wasn't too happy, but he cooled down quickly. Saturday arrived quickly. The judging was in the afternoon in the opera house in the recording hall. It seated around 1,200 people. Only a few contestants' friends were at the judging. It started at 1 p.m. and went through to 5 p.m., arranging the lighting and music, plus a few other items. Arnold and I left at 5 p.m., and I drove straight home to get changed for the show. Arnold came inside, and my mother gave him a cold drink. Some of the neighbors came in to meet him, all women, of course. Some brought their young daughters in. It delayed us a bit, but Arnold was his charming self. One woman said, "If I was only 20 years younger," but he was more interested in her young daughter. Only flirting, of course. Eventually, we got away and we headed to a friend's place. I was leaving my car in his garage and going in his car. I picked a nice restaurant down off the beach. It was 6 p.m. We had an hour to eat and run. Seeing the show was to start at 7 p.m., the service at the restaurant was slow, but the food was delicious. That was the main thing. By the time we arrived, the show had started. Paul was worried because Arnold was late. He wanted to discuss the program with him in his posing spot. The acts varied from jazz, ballet, to hand balancing, with the contestants posing in between. Juniors, novice, and the open division. The contest was the Mr. New South Wales, the state title, with around 40 entrants. The audience was all waiting for Arnold's appearance. The show was a sellout with a packed house. The time came and all the house lights were turned out with the only one spot overhead on the stage. The theme Exodus began. The acoustics in the recording hall were fantastic. The place had atmosphere. Arnold stepped out under the light with unbelievable gasps from the audience. He went straight into his posing routine, each pose better than the last. The audience applause at the end was loud. He was called back for another spot. He held the audience in the palm of his hand. The charisma flowed. He had that magnetic appeal that only a few people in the world have. Minutes after he stepped off stage, the applause was still there. He returned quickly to the stage dressed and he thanked the audience for their response and he answered some questions. This lasted for 15 minutes. At the end of the show, Arnold helped present the trophies and he thanked the audience for attending. The show was a success and afterwards he autographed photos, etc. for the fans. A get-together smorgasbord was arranged after the show for contestants and friends. It was held a few miles away at one of Paul's friends' business premises, a large parlor pool hall. The food was laid out with lots of goodies that bodybuilders like eating after contests. A good relaxing night to finish off the festivities with. Arnold's stay on his second trip was only 2 weeks altogether, 1 week before the show and another after. He relaxed a few days after and he prepared for his second appearance in Melbourne, 500 miles south. He flew down a few days before for a bit of publicity for the show. It was the Mr. Southern Hemisphere being held in a city cabaret. The press took a few shots, stripped to the waist posing, in the main street with a wide-angle lens to give the photos effect. The show was given a lot of publicity, and the cabaret was filled with tables, seating about 6 to 10 people placed all around the hall. The judging had been in the afternoon. The results had been decided. In the evening, the show was to begin at 8 p.m. We arrived early and had a table at the back of the hall. The night was hot, so we ordered a few beers to cool us down. After four or so, we were a little heavy under the eyes. Arnold was quite happy. Occasionally, people would pass to say hello and ask a few questions. He always obliged them. When it was his turn to pose, he made sure everyone was out of the change room because people bombarded him with questions. He came out and did his posing, and then he did a routine to strobe lights, and he left the stage quickly, followed by a mob of enthusiasts. They all bolted through the door after him just to get a closer look. It took 10 minutes to clear everyone out. He got dressed, and he came out greeted by a small applause. The questions were fired left and right and center. After 20 minutes or so, he left the stage. By this time, it was intermission, and he announced that he would be selling photos at the back of the hall and autographing them. To my surprise, the line consisted mostly of females, some leaving their phone numbers and names. I mentioned this to him, and he just smiled. The night ended late, and we didn't get to bed until early a.m. We all enjoyed our Melbourne trip. It was short but sweet. Arnold spent the last few days in Sydney before leaving for L.A. I remember one evening Arnold had this photo taken with Sydney's top football team. It was the beginning of the season, and the newspapers wanted interesting news. What better than Mr. Olympia playing for Sydney's top team? We drove out to the field where the team was gathered before practice. The evening was cool. It was the beginning of winter. In the dressing room, they were hunting around for a pair of shoes, shorts, and no way would a top fit them. So they decided to take a few shots posing, not flexing, around with the team just in shorts and shoes. When Arnold took off his top, most of the team couldn't believe how big he was, even though they picked out the biggest guys. He still dwarfed a lot. I took a few photos myself. Not many, because it was quick and cold and over in 10 minutes. One daytime TV program had Arnold as a guest. This program had mainly women as the audience, and they all lapped it up. His posing and interview went over very well. He gave a few seminars around the local gyms, training, posing, and answering questions for an hour or so. The seminars lasted for about 1.5 to 2 hours. Before we knew it, Arnold's stay was over again. I drove him out to the airport and said farewell. 1975 was the year. I was training hard, in good shape, and everything was going well for me. It was August, and our winter was finishing. The warm, sunny, hot days were with us. I received a phone call from Paul to tell me that he was promoting a state title contest, and he may bring Arnold out again as the guest star. I said, great. It had been over 16 months since he'd been out, and rumors were that this may be his last year competing, so it would be good to see him again, in good shape, before he retired. This time, Arnold flew in with Ken Waller. A quick interview and straight off to their motel. Ken was on his way to Japan to do a show, and this was a good opportunity to see Australia. I was training at the gym down the road, which was only a 10-minute walk, so it was ideal for them to have a few workouts, and it was right on the beach, a very compact area called Kugi. It was also a treat for the other members of the gym. I spent many hours with Arnold and Ken talking bodybuilding, etc. There was a pool in their motel. We spent a lot of time preparing for the contest, tanning there. I decided to enter the show, and I started training a lot harder, watching my diet and working out twice a day. Most mornings, I would pick Arnold up at his motel and then go to the gym at 8 a.m. for 2 hours. Ken would train with him in the evenings. At the time, I had a job managing a gym for a friend of mine, so I spent the evening training there. I did take a week off to fully prepare, and then I trained morning and evening with him. It was interesting to watch Arnold pose after he finished the set. He blows right up, and he looks very cut, which is unusual. In the early morning, his veins always seemed to be outstanding, especially on his arms and legs. One evening, we were doing seated calf raises. After 4 sets, he measured them at 19.5, and he said he'd make them 20 in 2 months. Ken and Arnold did a lot of donkey raises together, and they both had great calves. The evenings were spent quietly after training, just a nice meal, and the boys relaxed in their motel room talking, occasionally taking in a movie. The first time I asked Arnold and Ken to dinner, I went out that afternoon and I bought the biggest T-bone steaks I could find. Here in Australia, meat is cheap. They only cost $1 each. Ken told me in the U.S. they'd be $5 each. My mother prepared a lot, thinking that they were so big they'd need as much food as she could dish out. I gave Ken a chair that I forgot was only stuck together roughly, and when he sat down, it collapsed and he fell on his ass. He gave me a dirty look as if I'd done it intentionally, but I didn't. Arnold laughed for 5 minutes. My mother brought out the food with the plates piled full of meat, eggs, and salad. We all got stuck into it. Arnold took his time as he was watching a TV program at the same time, and it had him intrigued. After seconds and dessert, we all sat and had a rest for 15 minutes. Later, I took the boys into my room to show them the albums I collected over the years. They were mainly on the early bodybuilders like Reeves, Grimmick, Park, Arnold's early idol, etc. He was fascinated with the photos of Reeves, probably because I had so many, plus his original entry forms from the 1948 and 1950 Universe competitions, complete with measurements. He said that guy was so good looking and he had nice shape. Of course, early in Arnold's career, he was influenced by Reg Park, mainly with the size factor. But now he started to appreciate the Reeves style of physique. I think Arnold's very critical, but he's also correct with his criticism. He knows because he had to work hard to reach the top. He always gives credit where it's due. Many times he was impressed with smaller guys. He is a bodybuilder, not a big head. I remember when Zane won the Olympia, Arnold wrote and said, "I'm glad that Zane won the Olympia. He's a fantastic bodybuilder and a credit to the sport." That's the statement from a man, not an egotist. The day of the Mr. NSW contest arrived. I had been training in the mornings with Arnold for 2 weeks, and I looked okay to myself. I wasn't sure whether to enter the show, but a bit of coaxing from the boys, and I decided I would. Arnold had brought out some of his contest hand lotion with him. I got a bottle off him. I went home and applied the lotion with cotton wool, which was so slow in the end, I used a paintbrush, and I put on a few coats, and off I went to the judging. Being a contestant can be confusing to how you compare with the rest of the lineup. You can only give your best, and that afternoon I did. After the judging, I helped set up the lighting for the evening show. It was difficult because there was only one light set at a certain angle on the stage, and the posing platform was just right. After setting up, two friends and I went out to eat at a Chinese restaurant in between the rest period. We had over an hour to relax and talk about the comparisons. The meal was great, especially after the hectic time we'd just been through. We arrived back at the show a little late, but our stomachs were full and most of the stress was behind us. The juniors were on. We stood at the back of the hall and we watched the show. Ken Waller came out straight after the juniors and he gave a posing display, followed by a small speech to the audience. He had to leave immediately for the airport to catch his plane, and he only had a half hour to meet the deadline. He received a great applause. As he left, I shook hands with him, and he said, "I don't know how you went in the show, Robert, but all the best anyway." Ken was on his way to Japan to give an exhibition. He left his stay in Australia to the last moment. The show was in full swing, and most of the lineups and acts had been on. Only my open event and Arnold's spot were left to go, plus the presentation of the trophies. Our class went on first. I was backstage pumping up. I was in the middle, so I stood in the wings and I watched the guys pose. A lot of guys make the mistake of spending too much time pumping it. They overpump and they lose it as soon as the cold air hits them on the stage. When it was my turn on stage, I walked out and posed to a routine of a combination of poses. I had practiced last week. When on stage, you forget your nerves because you have to concentrate on the routine and give them all you got. Before long, our class had finished and it was Arnold's spot. The theme Exodus must be the most popular background theme to use to pose to for most bodybuilders. Reg Park was the first to use it, and when Arnold saw Reg pose to the music, it impressed him greatly. Wag Bennett in London suggested to Arnold that he should pose to music, so he stuck to Exodus. The dramatic music suits his physique. Paul Graham was the MC, and he gave a little speech about Arnold to the audience before he went on and then introduced him as the best-built man in the world. Arnold walked out slowly with a smile and stood relaxed for a moment, and then the Exodus theme began, and he hit a double bicep pose and then a twisting back. The audience applauded and lapped it all up. I noticed that when Arnold posed, his eyes seemed to be half-masked. Whether he was concentrating or whatever, he was in a different world. The lighting looked good that I had set up, excellent for photographs. Arnold's routine was fantastic. He came back and he did a second spot. All his poses were different to the audience's delight, too. I was sitting in the front row with my camera trying to get all his poses on film. I didn't need a flash because the light was so good. Luckily, I got most of them. His routine was over, and again, he answered questions from the audience, the usual steroids, sets, reps, diet, etc. At the finish of the show, Arnold presented the winners with their trophies. The juniors, novice, and finally the open, which I was fortunate to win, plus a few body parts, best arms, best abs, most muscular, and best poser. The guy that came second won the other body parts. He looked better proportionally, but he lost out due to smoothness. After the show, a reception was held for the contestants at a nearby local hotel. All the entrants and some of their friends came along. Everyone was talking about the show. Arnold was surrounded by girls, one feeling his thighs, etc. In general, a relaxing evening after a good show. The Mr. Australia show was being held a week later in Melbourne. I didn't intend entering, but Arnold persuaded me to. I shouldn't have because that extra week I gained 7 to 9 pounds of weight and I smoothed right out. The show was held at the town hall right in the center of the city. The attendance was good. The hall was a sellout. There were several other acts with the show which caused it to run a bit overtime. Karate, singing acts, dancing, etc. A lot of guys from Sydney drove down to enter or see the show. The roads aren't the best either. 600 miles of it. We flew, so we got it easy, just over an hour. It was a rush drive down and straight back after the show for the others. Again, Arnold was the center of attraction. When he arrived in the city, he was in all the newspapers and on a local TV program advertising the contest. One commentator asked Arnold where he bought the sweater he was wearing. It fit like a glove. He replied that he bought it at a shop in the town. It was a big make, extra, extra large, and the shop owner couldn't sell it because it was too big to fit any of his customers, so he got it at a special price. Believe me, for a super large sweater, it was skin tight on him. Melbourne's a quiet city. It's all set out in square blocks, and to me, all the streets look the same when you get out in the suburbs. After the contest, there was a reception given in one of the gyms. We got lost several times, but eventually found it. We were all starving, too, so it was a welcome relief to get some food into our stomachs. After the contest parties, they always serve the best food. Lots of meat and all varieties, salads, etc. The next day, some of the Sydney boys flew back, including Arnold. He only had a few more days left before he left for Los Angeles. He kept training, but only once a day, in the evenings around 5 or 6. I had dinner with him several times at the restaurant in the motel. He always had a lot of interesting stories to tell me. Competitions he entered and people he had met, little things that happened in the gym, etc. I suppose I got to know Arnold better than most, and personally I found him to be a very interesting and likable person. He's a very genuine guy and generous. The people in Australia were very impressed with his physique and his magnetic personality. I read a few items in various newspapers and magazines written by women mostly, criticizing the average physical pot-gutted male and praising the superior physique of Schwarzenegger. And one woman said he was a credit to manhood. She only wished more men took an interest in their bodies. The day Arnold left, I picked him up at his motel and I drove him out to the airport. He said his goodbyes to all his friends and he was on his way home to LA. Since 1972, I've been corresponding with him up to this day, and he's always replied to my letters. In fact, he hasn't missed one letter. I feel that he's put so much effort into bodybuilding in the last 12 years, and it was so demanding that he was due for a rest. He's the perfect ambassador for the game, and he's still promoting bodybuilding, not only in America, but around the world. I think Arnold has done more for the game in this day and age than anyone. I realize he's now getting into movies, and he'll make a name for himself here also. Maybe one day he'll decide to get into top shape again for exhibitions or whatever. It's okay to see photos of him, but to see Arnold in the flesh is an experience in itself after all. So far, there's only been one Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't think there'll be another one like him to come on the scene for a long, long time. Wow, that was an excellent article, wasn't it? It was so like in depth. And Robert had so many experiences with Arnold. In his peak, 72, 74, 75. That was amazing. Those are great trade articles. Long one, too. All right, this one comes from the April 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness. Franco is on the cover, arm wrestling a girl. Looks like he's losing. And it's called Zane, Reframing the Nightmare by Armad Tani. And this, of course, was right after the 1980 Mr. Olympia, where Frank went in as the defending three-time Mr. Olympia champ, and he lost the very controversial Mr. Olympia to Arnold and also to Chris Dickerson, and Frank took third place. So he dropped from the reigning champ to third place, which was obviously a nightmare for him. It starts off with a quote from the philosopher Carl Jung. "To experience defeat is also to experience victory. Nothing is disturbed either inwardly or outwardly, for one's own continuity has withstood the current of life and time." Every year, months before entering the Mr. Olympia, Frank Zane has traditionally had a dream whose interpretation prophesies his forthcoming victory. Each dream readjusted his spirit, made the grueling training experience ahead more tolerable. "In the past 3 years, my dreams have all been about winning," says Frank. "We're sitting in the den of the Spanish colonial home he recently bought. The house is a stone's throw from the beach at Santa Monica. Frank is barefooted and wears Levi's and a t-shirt. He's gained weight since the Olympia show in Sydney and looks massive. Open suitcases scattered about remind you of his hectic travel schedule. This year I had a nightmare. I wasn't actually during the night. It was an actual living nightmare. I think reframing the nightmare would make a good title. What I mean is taking a picture of the nightmare and putting it in a new frame, looking at it from a new perspective. instead of looking at it as a tragedy and dwelling on it and feeling sorry about everything, I want to take it and use it as a way to motivate myself in the future, make myself more successful. Up to this point, I've been wondering how Frank would take his loss to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Chris Dickerson in the Olympia. Not anymore. The Zane spirit obviously continues to be hardline optimism. When things happen in life, you really don't know whether they're good or bad at the time that they happen, he continues. It may seem tragic, but maybe not in the long run. It seems that way with me. Maybe it's not all that tragic. I think I should start with the first Zane Invitational Women's Bodybuilding Championship last June. I got into really good shape for my exhibition at that show. I was in exactly the shape I had been planning to be in. Heavy, strong, and highly trained. After that, Christine and I took a week's vacation in Mexico to relax. The plan was to come back and train heavy and hard. During the month of July, I built my weight up to 210 pounds. I was doing rep squats with 375, and I was strong on everything. I was getting massive. I knew that if I would have continued with that trend and gradually trimmed down to 200 by the time of the Olympia contest, I would have been in incredible shape. Last year, Frank had made heavy powerlifting part of his bodybuilding training. When he won the 1979 Olympia, he was more massive and cut up than he had ever been before. It was the 1st of August at our Palm Springs home, he goes on, picking dates and facts from the written training log that he keeps. I was about to start my training day with a bit of hot sun, but as I went to lie on a deck chair, I tumbled into the pool, and a sharp edge of the chair sliced across the base of my urethra, right between my legs. I began bleeding through the urinary tract. I landed in the hospital, and I lost about a quart of blood the first day. I spent 4 days in the hospital and 2 more days at home with a catheter in me. When they removed it, I was a week away from a scheduled exhibition in Canada. He laughs at the thought of it. Imagine, an exhibition in a week, and I felt as if it were a toss-up whether I was going to live or die. In fact, a week after the accident, at home resting, I started hemorrhaging again. It lasted for 18 hours, and I lost more blood, over a quart. I lay back for 4 more days inactive, and finally, after clearance from my doctor, I began taking walks. He advised me not to use weights since the bleeding could start up any time in the next 6 weeks. At the time, I felt a sense of relief. I don't have to go to the Olympia this year. I don't have to go through all that hard, hard training. I could take it easy because there was no way I could be ready for the contest. Blood all over the place. It was a week before the exhibition that the bleeding started up again. I called Canada and tried to cancel, but they said, oh no, the crowd wants to see you. They tried to get a replacement, but all the guys were busy, so I had to go. I had one workout in 2.5 weeks. I had lost 20 pounds, and I was down to 190. I looked all right, you know, but I couldn't even tense my abdominals. I couldn't work my legs. Barely out of the hospital, and I had to perform. I felt funny about it. My stamina was low. Christine went with me to Canada to keep watch over me. I gave the exhibition and the seminar the following day. I made it through, but I felt funny knowing I was not in top shape. I didn't say much about it. The Olympia contest was just ahead. Frank returned home uncertain of what lay ahead. He was healing fast, as only a man in his superb condition could. Both Christine and his doctor agreed that he should defend his Olympia title. The doctor told him that once he had healed, he could do everything he had done before. But Frank had lost precious time and stamina. He had no time to rebuild his body weight. He would have to stay around 190 and continue training at that weight, which wasn't the original game plan at all. I had kept in touch with Arnold at that time, he says. In other years, both Arnold and Joe Weider had served as critics. I told Arnold about my injury, and he said that I should go ahead and enter the Olympia, defend my title. So that was it. I started training with 6 weeks to go. I trained hard for about 10 days, and I gave an exhibition at the George Snyder Show. People who see me both in Canada and there remarked how much better I looked. I was making a fast recovery, but I was still far from top shape. With only a few weeks left until the Olympia in Australia, I had no time to regain weight. I knew I had to get as defined as possible at 190 without sacrificing size. When I left for the Olympia, I was 190, the same as I weighed in 79. Yet I appeared smaller, which was no doubt the result of those lost weeks of planned heavy training. Perhaps I shouldn't have entered the contest. Perhaps it's for the better, though. I don't like to sit on a defeat. I'm not made that way. I don't know what's going to happen now. I've certainly had my share of competition. I'll take it easy for a while, give more time to my business. In January, the Zanes were to open their exercise and fitness spa in Palm Springs. People from all over will be accepted for live-in seminars of 5 days and 4 nights. Only 8 people at a time will be taken, and both Frank and Christine will administer the program, in-depth and personalized. They'll work on each person's problems, explaining exercise, nutrition, and aerobics. Interest in the program is growing. The cost, according to Frank, would be about the same as an average vacation. For anyone serious about training and getting in shape, the benefits would be great. Frank's entire career has been a personal experiment, and he's packaged 20 years of instinctive training lore that one could hardly afford to pass up. During the summer months, when the temperature in Palm Springs goes up, Frank will offer lengthy seminars for advanced bodybuilders. In the past couple of years, he has learned the advantage of training in the desert heat in preparation for the Olympia contest. Such seminars may last for a month or more. This seminar program will be known as Zane Haven. As an old Californian, this writer can fully appreciate the benefits of training in the summer heat. When muscles are sore from training, dry atmospheric heat has the soothing effect of a hot compress. What about competing again? I'm not sure about competition this year, he says. I may turn up anytime, anywhere, and I may not. The answer is sardonic. He gives a mirthless little laugh. He's thinking of Arnold's sudden, unheralded entry into the Olympia contest in Australia. My training was going very good until that accident, and it's going good now, he continues quickly, avoiding further comment on Arnold at that point. I'm going to get my body weight up. I've always been criticized for being small. I was at my biggest in last year's Olympia. This year was the same old criticism, too small. At contest time this year, I actually weighed about 5 pounds less than last year, but my muscularity was very good, as you could see in the photos. I was disappointed in the contest this year, not so much because I didn't win. I think any one of 3 or 4 people could have won. Besides myself, Boyer Coe could have won. Chris Dickerson could have won, although I don't think he was in his best shape. I think Mike Mentzer could have won. He looked good in the prejudging, but typically he loses the edge by the time the evening show rolls around. Maybe he goes out and eats after the prejudging. I don't know. I had Arnold picked for 5th place. I talked to a lot of people who would have placed him even lower. If you saw the Arnold of old and you saw the Arnold of 1980, you wouldn't know it's the same person. It makes sense that you don't train hard for 5 years and then you train hard for 8 weeks. Some of your body will make it back. Your strong points. Sure, he had biceps and the pecs were there and his back was decent, but his thighs were totally missing. His presentation was poor. And what I didn't especially like about the whole thing was the way he made a mockery of the prejudging. He fooled around on stage laughing just to attract attention. Maybe it's sour grapes. Everybody more or less feels something's wrong when they lose. I prefer to look at it from the perspective of what I will do from now on. I more or less know, but I just don't think things were the way they should have been over in Australia. For its own sake, the IFBB should look into it further. Such a fair shouldn't be allowed to happen. If the decision was close, it would be a different story, but it wasn't even close. I'm glad to have won the Olympia 3 times, and whether I'll go in it again, I don't know. I do know that I will be at Zane Haven in Palm Springs, and I will give posing exhibitions and seminars. I do know that if and when I return to competition, I will be bigger than ever before. The author is familiar with the ordeal of contest training, having had to face the top pros, Grimmick, Reeves, Ross, more than a generation ago. I've been on the scene in the heat of many modern muscle battles. I would rather write about it now. In the past year, I've often wondered what Zane had to gain by going into another Olympia contest, or lose for that matter. He had unquestionably proven his point. The fierce training had become the competition, a competition with himself. The contest was almost a postscript. Frank attempts to answer. I felt funny about it, he explains. I should have followed my instincts because I felt I shouldn't go in it. I tend to put a lot of stock in what people say sometimes, especially if it's worked in the past. It was fortunate that I could even come in 3rd after what happened. My injury was more serious than people thought. I made really rapid recovery because I had to. I took tons of food supplements. Plus, I was in shape. I had an interesting dream when I was in the hospital. I interpreted it to mean that I was getting better. I'm in the kitchen of my boyhood home in Pennsylvania. I hear some noise in the living room. I enter the room and there's about 30 shabby skid row type bums sitting in a circle. What are these guys doing in my house? I go into the center of the circle and say, "You're uninvited guests in my house, so get the hell out." Suddenly they all disappear. Upon awakening, I put the dream on paper and I figured it out. Those shabby bums in the house where I live represent all the negative thoughts I had about the whole Olympia idea. When one is having a traumatic experience, it's hard to tell yourself that everything's going to be all right. A positive attitude is easy when you're in top shape, free of injuries. In a sick bed, the positive attitude falters. Little disturbances become bothersome. What I did in the dream was go in and break up these shabby, negative thoughts. Throw them out. It was the dream that told me that I would make it through this accident. I think it was accurate. My dreams have always had special significance. Frank had a lot of time for reflection when he was recovering, and he read Carl Jung's Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. In one section of the book read, "At the beginning of the illness, I had the feeling there was something wrong with my attitude, that I was, to some extent, responsible for the mishap. But when one follows the path of individuation, one wins one's own life. One must take mistakes into the bargain. Life would not be complete without them. There is not a guarantee for a single moment that we will not fall into error or stumble into deadly peril. We may think there is a sure road, but that would be the road of death. Then nothing happens any longer. At any rate, not the right things. Anyone who takes the sure road is as good as dead. It was only after the illness that I understood how important it is to affirm one's own destiny. In this way, we forge an ego that does not break down when incomprehensible things happen. An ego that endures the truth and is capable of coping with the world and with fate. Then to experience defeat is also to experience victory. Nothing is disturbed either inwardly or outwardly, for one's own continuity has withstood the current of life and time. That can come to pass only when one does not meddle inquisitively with the workings of fate." That is what Jung said, and it hit home because at that time, it was exactly the situation I was in. It was a totally incomprehensible thing to happen. I couldn't understand why. It was all so sudden and so very fast. That's the way it is when you take a risk. You open yourself up to anything and everything. Life without risk is nowhere. You don't get ahead. You do the same thing all your life. If you desire change, you must take risks, and with them comes a sometimes deadly peril. As Jung says, whether it's victory or defeat, it doesn't matter because your own inner continuity is not disturbed. This is the way I have come to feel about my injury and the Olympia affair. This is how I've come to reframe my nightmare. And then there's a correction at the end of the article. It says, the report in Jack Neary's article in the February Muscle and Fitness that I smashed my trophy in the parking lot after the last Olympia contest was totally inaccurate. Naturally, after all the hard work I put in, I was very disappointed that I didn't win. But when I was announced as the third place finisher, I gave another posing exhibition to the best of my ability. And when I was leaving the Sydney Opera House with my wife Christine after the contest, 300 to 400 of my fans gave me an ovation. Good sportsmanship is part of being a champion. I want all my fans and supporters to know that smashing trophies in parking lots is certainly not my idea of good sportsmanship. Frank Zane. All right. That was a great article. I love reading articles about Frank Zane from during that time when he was winning the Olympia because he was so inquisitive and thoughtful and introspective about everything. And that's what really made him such a great champion. I really admired that about him. All right. Let's go to the next article here. This comes from the March 1979 issue of Muscle and Fitness. Actually, I'm sorry. It was Muscle Builder. And this was covering a lot of great contests in this magazine. It covers the 1978 Mr. America that we just talked about that Tony Pearson won. And it also covers the 1978 Mr. Universe that was held in Acapulco that was won by everyone from the American team. They set the record. Carlos Rodriguez won the lightweight. Tom Platz won the middleweight. And Mike Mentzer finally won the heavyweight. So Mike Mentzer was second place to Robbie in 1976 at the Mr. Universe. And then he was heavily favored to win the next year, but he was beaten by Cal Scalak. So he took another second place. So this year was the year that Mike won, and he scored a perfect 300 score. So our friend Rick Wayne wrote an article called The Bodybuilding Strategy of Mike Mentzer. And this was in, again, the March issue of 1979 Muscle Builder magazine. It said, when he was only a skinny 12-year-old, Mike Mentzer had a close encounter of the most mundane kind, but he knew the minute it occurred that his life would never be quite the same afterwards. Today, at 27, he recalls the experience. I know it sounds like a corny advertisement from some Batman comic book, he says, putting away a batch of fan mail that he's been trying unsuccessfully all morning to answer. But that's exactly how I discovered the world of bodybuilding. I was browsing around a magazine stand in Pennsylvania, my hometown, when I saw this picture of Steve Reeves looking up at me. Of course, I had no idea at the time who Reeves was, and I certainly, the name Joe Weider was quite foreign to me. But the moment I saw that copy of Muscle Builder with Reeves on the cover, I knew what I was going to do with my life. He bought the magazine, took it home for more clinical study. That Christmas, he recalls, Dad bought me my first set of barbells. I did say it was mundane. Mike started training the day his barbell set arrived. The family basement would undergo a few minor changes so that it looked less like a place for storing junk and more like Mike's idea of a gym. I was quite skinny then, says Mentzer. I had done a lot of calisthenics, you know, chins, push-ups, that sort of thing at school, just like most of the other boys. But when I got my weights and I read through the course that came with the set, well, here was the real thing. He gained easily. He says today that even though he didn't know it at the time, anyone with an eye for such things could have seen that he was born for bodybuilding. I'm fortunate to have had the right parents, he says. I inherited my father's structure. In the beginning, Mike Mentzer trained 3 days a week, three sets per body part, 10 reps per set. And the results were most encouraging. So encouraging, in fact, that Mike decided to speed up the process. I made one of the most common errors in bodybuilding, he has said. Like so many other newcomers to the sport, I reasoned that if three sets per body part could bring such great results, then 10 sets would work that many times faster. How wrong can you get? You'd be surprised the number of bodybuilders who still think this way. The rationale is, of course, contrary to all the laws of physiology. Had I continued to train the way I began, I'd have done much better and arrived at my goal a lot quicker. Instead, I soon got into training 6 times a week, doing set after set, going crazy with enthusiasm. By the time he joined the Air Force, Mike had settled down into a training regimen of 24 sets of body part, training every day, as advocated by most muscle magazines at the time. But I'm not the sort of person who will continue blindly when it's obvious to everyone that I'm standing still. I started asking myself all kinds of questions, Mike says. Why wasn't I getting the expected results for my workouts? Why wasn't I gaining weight and size? Why was I always so tired for days after my workout? I mean, I was doing everything the magazines recommended. It got so that I trained for nearly 3 hours and I still couldn't get a pump. Of course, what I was doing without realizing was this. I was depleting my energy. In short, I was overtraining. There I was in the Air Force working 12 hours a day. I had a girlfriend whom I hardly ever took out. I was thinking about going back to school. Really, it was difficult trying to justify the hours I spent at the gym. Really, I had nothing to show for my efforts, but I still kept going, even though I knew in my heart that what I was doing couldn't be right. My instincts told me to try something else, but at the time, I believed everything I read in the magazines. Like so many bodybuilders today, I held as sacred anything put out by the so-called bodybuilding authorities. There was no way anyone was going to convince me that what I read had absolutely no scientific basis, Mentzer says today. I convinced myself that the fault was with me, not the advice dished out through the various magazines. Until he met Casey Viator. Casey really amazed me, Mike says. At the time, he was being discussed in the same breath as Arnold Schwarzenegger. We became friends, and I learned that he too had trained along the conventional route for some time, but had changed direction after a while when it became obvious that what he had been doing made no sense whatsoever. Casey introduced me to a whole new concept of bodybuilding. He encouraged me to study the mechanics of exercise. The first author I came across who seemed to deal with the subject of physical exercise based on scientific data was Arthur Steinhaus, an exercise physiologist from the University of Illinois. For the first time, I learned about the concept of training intensity. According to Steinhaus, German physiologists as far back as the 19th century had shown muscle growth to be directly related to training intensity, not training duration, as many seem to think. Training intensity and training duration are inversely proportional. That is to say, the harder you train, the less time you'll be able to spend working out. In other words, if you train really hard, a 3-hour workout will be impossible. Mike admits he believed everything he heard from Casey. I could see the results in Viator, and emotionally I accepted all he said, but it was some time before I actually accepted the fact that my way of bodybuilding is the only route to go. It took 7 years before I came to accept that fact intellectually. Mike began training scientifically in 1971, only to be struck down by a severe shoulder injury that put him out of bodybuilding for nearly 2 years. I'd been doing so well, he recalls. I placed second to Casey Viator for best arms and best legs at the AAU Mr. America contest. But that injury really broke me up. I became depressed, felt sorry for myself. And before you knew it, I was fat and horribly out of shape. The accident occurred one day as I was doing flies. I felt my shoulder suddenly snap, as if the joint had come apart. Let me tell you, I was up to a fat 250 pounds by the time I returned to the gym. That was back in 1974. Mike had no fixed goal in mind except maybe to trim down somewhat. He remembers doing just two exercises a body part, 10 sets per workout. He trained the whole body in one session, a session that comprised just five exercises. But the truth is, I started making such rapid progress, I was amazed. That, of course, says a lot about my genetic structure, or maybe the efficiency of the form of training I was doing at the time. Maybe both. Before you knew it, my mind was functioning correctly again, and I was thinking about competing. I went on a severe diet, fasting one whole day a week. I ate no solid food on Mondays, and I kept this up for 3 months. I remember I was in college at the time, and I never wavered from that diet. Yes, I ate nothing at all one day each week, and the other days I stuck to a restricted diet. I brought my weight down to around 195 pounds, and I felt I wasn't losing anymore. So I cut the diet down even further. Now I was having just one egg and a salad a day. My weight went down to 187, and even then I thought I still looked fat. My strength suffered, of course, but I wasn't too worried about that. All I wanted to do was strip away the fat so I could start building muscle again. Finally, I went from 187 to 212 pounds with hard training and an increased caloric intake, but most of that was muscle. Then I thought I was beginning to smooth out again. I was training in Washington, D.C. at the time. It was not the best time for me to compete, but that's exactly what I did. I entered the AABA Mr. America contest staged that year in Los Angeles, and I lost to Roger Callard and Robbie Robinson. I placed third. I wasn't too unhappy about that. It brought me some good publicity. I competed at a body weight of 196 pounds, and I was quite muscular. I managed to drop from 212 to 196. And then he made another bodybuilding error. He'd been on a restricted carbohydrate diet while preparing for the Mr. America contest. Well, now the battle was over. He succumbed to the craving for junk food. In a matter of days, he said, I was Porky Pig all over again. I was so stupid of me. I'd been stuffing myself with all those carbo foods just 2 months before my next big contest, the Mr. USA. That contest was staged in New York. I'm afraid I let a lot of people down who have been rooting for me. But I learned a lesson. I thought 2 months was ample time for getting ready. Now I know better. But that September, I looked very bad indeed. So bad, in fact, that many people wrote Mensur off after the Mr. USA. How could they have known that Mike would learn from bitter experience and be unbeatable come 1976? He had trained very successfully for the AABA Mr. America contest. His 3 days a week schedule that incorporated all he learned from Viator and the various physiology manuals he managed to get his hands on. Now he would pull out all the stops, knowing in his blood that was really the only way to go, the only scientific system of bodybuilding in the world. Hardly anything was heard of Mensur in the months leading up to the 1976 IFBB American Championships. True, the word filtered down that he was in phenomenal shape, but mainly the consensus was that Mike Mensur was no big threat. Ah, but he was more than that, as it turned out. For he stole the show, he and his brother Ray. Both of them won their divisions and astounded all who saw their performances. Now everyone wanted to know what the hell the Mensurs had been doing to bring about their incredible transformation. There had been talk of a routine based on the principle of pre-exhaustion, but in truth it simply didn't make sense. Who ever heard of anyone looking like Ray and Mike after following a four-day-a-week training program? Moreover, it was said that the brothers' workouts lasted no more than 45 minutes. And to top it all off, the rumor had it was that they hardly ever did more than three sets per body part. Insane. Mike would explain the mystery in time. You have to understand all exercises are divided into two distinct phases, he said. You have the concentric contraction phase that occurs when you raise a weight and the eccentric contraction that occurs when you lower the weight. It is a controversial point right now, but some eminent exercise physiologists hold the greatest benefit from an exercise is derived from the eccentric or negative contraction. The Weider principle of reverse gravity training allows you to handle the heaviest poundages productively even after a muscle has been exhausted from raising the weight. You'll find that it's impossible to do the first part of the barbell curl after a certain number of reps, but that you can still do the lowering part. All you have to do is get that weight up to the top position. Say someone fingers it up to the shoulders for you, and you then control the lowering of the barbell all the way down to the full hang position. As I say, long after it becomes impossible to curl the weight on your own, you'll be able to do 3 or 4 reverse gravity reps. Reverse gravity reps will increase the intensity of training and force the muscles to respond more positively to exercise. And what does Mike mean by training to exhaustion? The principle has already been explained. Remember what I said earlier about curling until you need help and getting the weight up? Remember how we then went into negative resistance by controlling the lowering of the weight? Well, here is the perfect example of training to exhaustion. Try it and you'll know. I enjoy doing the preacher curl to exhaustion and following that up immediately with heavy concentration curls. As far as Mike Mentzer and exercise physiologists are concerned, the most important factor in successful bodybuilding is training intensity. He considers it imperative that bodybuilders spend less time at the gym, which is not to say that they should not train very hard, merely that they should try to cut down on workout time while at the same time increasing the stress placed on the various muscles. You can't beat the weeder quality training principles in your workout, he says. The number of hours a man spends at the gym could well be an indication of the sort of workout he gets. At present, Mike does about 30 exercises for his whole body. He trains 4 times a week, working chest, triceps, and legs on Monday and Thursday. On Tuesdays and Fridays, he trains his back, traps, deltoids, biceps, and abdominals. On the average, he employs just 2 exercises per body part. My first chest movement is the pectoral squeeze performed on the pec deck machine. The action forces the pectorals together under heavy pressure. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the exhaustion principle is used here. When I've done the maximum number of reps possible, my partner helps me with the squeeze action, but I stay in control as much as I'm able. Right after the squeezes, I do incline dumbbell presses for a superset, again with the same force reps exhaustion principles. I do just 2 supersets in that way. That's all you need for a really fantastic pump. Try it and you'll know what hard training is all about. I don't perform the bench press, which many people consider the best chest exercise there is. Actually, that's a better by far for the triceps and deltoids. I don't think much of the straight arm pullover is a rib cage enlarger either. There isn't much you can do to enlarge a rib cage anyway past the age of 19 to 22. Following my chest work, my triceps are already pumped from the dumbbell pressing. I move on to direct tricep work. It doesn't matter what tricep movements you use, whether it's the seated French press or cable pulls, the idea is to work them to exhaustion. Use the force reps principle and not waste energy doing set after useless set. Pick 2 exercises and superset them exactly as I explained earlier with my chest work. 2 or 3 supersets of the 2 movements are enough. My thighs come next. My first exercise is the leg extension. I pack on the weight and I squeeze out the last possible rep, no more than 10. Then without pause, I get under the leg press machine and I blast hell out of my thighs for about 8 reps. Then I practice some reverse gravity training. That is, I try to take most of the stress on one leg as the weight comes down. Both legs get the treatment. Then I get over to the squat rack for as many reps as possible with about 475 pounds. I do 1 tri-set of this torture. Suffice it to say that my thighs now measure 27 inches and they've never been more defined. The real proof of the efficiency of Mike's decidedly revolutionary training method surfaced in Mexico this November when he once again claimed the Mr. America title at the IFBB World Championships. That should be a Mr. Universe title. All right. Thank you, Rick Wayne. Great article on Mike Mentzer. He was just turning pro after winning the Mr. Universe. All right, guys. So that's all we've got. Some really great articles this week from the old bodybuilding archives, Muscle Builder, Muscle and Fitness, and of course that Muscle Mag annual that is a great, great issue. All 4 of those issues are great. I'll definitely keep going back to those for some more articles to read for you guys. And again, if you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor, just go to the link below and click on it and you can check out the different tiers we have for as little as $5 a month if you want to help support the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I appreciate you, all you Patreon sponsors who continue to sponsor the show month after month. You guys are the lifesavers of this show. All right, guys, that's all we got for this week. Hopefully we will have a guest next week. I'm trying to get Diana Dennis, the great woman bodybuilder from the 1980s. She was one of the pioneers of couples posing with her boyfriend, Kevin Lawrence, at the time. So hopefully we can get Diana on the show. She is a also a great expert on posing. That would be great to talk to her about that, as well as the beginning of women's bodybuilding in the 1980s. But until then, I will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. You guys keep training hard, stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Take care.